I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Andrew Chestnut. He is a professor of religious studies at Virginia Commonwealth University. His most recent book is Devoted to Death, Santa Muerte, the Skeleton Saint. He also blogs for the Huffington Post. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me back, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure.
So last time you were on the show, we spoke about the Santa Muerte, the skeleton saint. Remind us who she is.
She is a Mexican folk saint who is in skeletal form, personifies death. And I actually, in the book, call her the Grim Reaperess, because if you look at her iconography, basically, she's a female Grim Reaper. And indeed, the Spanish Catholic Church, when they came over to the Americas for the first time, brought over their female version of the Grim Reaper, who in Spain was known as La Parca, or the Parched One.
I mean, it's funny terminology that people use for things. Some people say she is worshipped. I'm not sure if that's exactly the right term. She is used. She is a part of a kind of devotional cult that really spans the Americas.
Yeah, indeed. The fascinating thing is that we have the first mention of her in Mexico from Spanish colonial times, dating back to the 1790s, in the annals of the Spanish Inquisition, when certain indigenous groups in central Mexico were discovered venerating a figure that they actually called La Santa Muerte. And then after that, she goes underground in the Mexican historical record for a century and a half, only to resurface in the 1940s, 1950s in the form of field notes of both American and Mexican anthropologists, and really doesn't become a public cult that she is today until 12 years ago. So for the great majority of her presence in Mexico, she was a figure of the occult, and it's only been the last decade or so that most Mexicans even know who she is.
When we talk about the occult, for you as a professor of religious studies, as somebody who thinks about these things very carefully, what does that mean? What does that word mean?
Well, in this sense, I'm really referring to the fact that she was, at least in the 1940s and 50s, what she primarily was doing was love magic, a love sorceress, that mostly Mexican women were petitioning her to go after their boyfriends or husbands that they thought were behaving badly, and to do love binding on these men and to bring them back humbled at their feet. And so she really was a figure that was, although her origins very much are in Spanish medieval Catholicism, was really used more for magic and sorcery, at least back in the 1940s and 50s. Since then, she's morphed into something else.
And that something else is she's used for any number of purposes, and those purposes are represented by the different colored candles that are sold in botanicas to represent kind of different domains of the human experience.
Exactly. That's been one of the major and most fascinating transformations is, again, in those field notes from mid-20th century, we know that she's really only a figure of love magic, whereas today she's a potent multitasker and can help devotees resolve a whole gamut of issues or problems they might be facing, such as legal ones. A lot of small businesses in Mexico have a in-store altar or at least votive candles, so their business will prosper. And still, in Mexico, the number one selling votive candle is the red candle, symbolizing matters of love and passion. So yeah, she's morphed from kind of a single-issue love sorceress to the most potent multitasker on the religious landscape of Mexico and increasingly parts of the United States.
Why is a love sorceress represented by the Grim Reaper, a dead skeleton? It seems so incongruous.
Yeah, it's really not clear because, again, she vanishes from the Mexican historical record for 150 years or so. So we really don't know at what point this figure of the Grim Reaperess kind of syncretizes or merges with Spanish Mediterranean love magic. We just don't know. That's missing from the historical record. So one can only speculate about that, unfortunately. But we do know that back in Spain in the Mediterranean, that the Grim Reaper and Grim Reaperess was not associated with love magic. So that obviously was an innovation that took place on Latin American soil.
So the Santa Muerte is loved by many people and used by many people in a very kind of the way people have the practice of religion, the practical part of their spiritual practice. But she's hated by a lot of the authorities, including the Mexican government and now the Vatican. Why?
Right. In fact, that's the newest development in the Catholic Church's campaign against her, is that one of the chief top Vatican officials denounced her a month ago at the Vatican, and then last week was in Mexico on a four-day tour, and on three separate occasions condemned Santa Muerte as blasphemous against religion, sinister, infernal. Why? Well, on the theological front, Christianity kind of sees death somewhat tantamount as the enemy of Jesus Christ, who came to give us eternal life. So the thinking is that as a Christian, you shouldn't be venerating or perhaps even worshiping a figure of death, which is kind of the antithesis of Jesus Christ, who came to give us eternal life. So that would kind of be the theological basis.
Don't Catholics venerate a dead guy on a cross?
Yes, but the emphasis is supposed to be on the resurrection and in the sacrifice that he made to give the rest of us who believe in him and the Father eternal life. So the emphasis is supposed to be on life. But yeah, there's no doubt that the Catholic Church has a long history of employing the iconography of death, the human skeleton, the grim reaper and such. But it's a completely different animal to have a figure that's here being venerated, worshipped, and asked to do miracles than it is to have a human skeleton personifying death as the Grim Reaper did for centuries in Europe.
So is it, I mean, the Vatican or whatever thinks this is bad theology, or do they just not want the competition?
I would say it's both. It's bad theology, but it's also competition as well. In fact, that's one of the main reasons I would argue and have argued is that why we have our first Latin American pope in Pope Francis, because Latin America is home to some 42% of the world's Catholics, yet the church has been in steady decline since the 1950s. As late as the decade of the 1940s, Latin America was 99% Catholic, and today that figure has plummeted to only 70%. Mexico is the second largest Catholic country on earth after Brazil, declining Catholic membership there. And yes, so Santa Muerte is also competition, and even more so since the great majority of her devotees in Mexico still claim to be Catholic. So yes, there's also the factor of religious competition as well.
So they claim to be Catholic. Now, Catholics have historically used all kinds of saints. I mean, this is nothing new.
No, this is nothing new at all. As you rightly point out, there's thousands of Catholic saints. But the big difference here is that Santa Muerte is not a Catholic saint. She's a folk saint who has been rendered holy by people's beliefs, but has not been accepted or canonized by the Catholic Church. And she is one of scores of these folk saints who command widespread devotion from Argentina to Mexico and here in the United States as well, who have not been sanctioned by the Catholic Church and many times are seen as competitors. But interestingly, so far, the only one who's really been singled out for condemnation of all the scores of folk saints is Santa Muerte from Mexico.
Because she is the most widely used?
Yeah, because her cult, again, going back to that point that my parents-in-law, who live in the western state of Michoacan and are in their 80s, had not heard of Santa Muerte, living in Mexico their entire life, until I, their gringo son-in-law, introduced them to Santa Muerte. So, yeah, most Mexicans had never heard. And today we're looking at, you know, maybe close to 8 to 10 million followers on both sides of the border. So the rapidity of the mushrooming of this cult is just awesome, and that's what has the Vatican really worried. In addition to the fact that the Pope is Argentine, and I should point out that the second of the three skeletal folk saints is the Argentine San La Muerte, who's fairly popular throughout the Argentine Republic.
We're talking to Professor of Religious Studies Andrew Chestnut. So, one of the things that it seems like is that the Catholic Church sometimes does better and sometimes not so well in serving the poor, which is ostensibly one of its main missions. How's that particular mission going right now?
Yeah, that's really interesting that you should bring that up, because in the very short time since Pope Francis has been the new pontiff, we've just seen every day he's making some kind of statement on behalf of the poor of the world. And it seems like we almost have a new preferential option for the poor, which was so talked about in Latin America during the 1960s and the 1970s under the rubric of liberation theology. It's almost like he's resurrected this so-called preferential option for the poor. And that's also really interesting from kind of the religious marketplace framework as well, because more than anything else in Latin America, it's been the poor who've been leaving the Catholic Church down there to mostly become Pentecostals. But also, obviously, we have competition from folk saints as well. So more than any other segment of society, it's specifically poor women who the Catholic Church is really concerned about, particularly in Latin America. So besides whatever theological arguments you can find for a preferential option for the poor, there's also the competitive strategical focus on the poor, because they're the ones who've left the Catholic Church in droves in Latin America since the 1950s.
Whatever happened to liberation theology? We don't hear that much about it now.
Yeah, it's been kind of moribund. I think some of the older guys like Leonardo Boff in Brazil have become excited by the Pope's pronouncements on poverty and such. But in general, it has been eclipsed by a far more dynamic movement in the Catholic Church known as the Catholic Charismatic Renewal, who are basically Catholic Pentecostals. In fact, during their first 5 or 7 years of operation, both here in the U.S., where they were born, and in Latin America, they actually called themselves Catholic Pentecostals. And so they really are far more dynamic throughout Latin America than the liberation theology movement, which is basically, as I said before, kind of moribund. So they're the ones, in terms of lay movements in Latin America, who really are kind of carrying the day for the church in terms of mass media, evangelization, etc.
It seems like liberation theology was associated with the kind of leftist movements in which workers were trying to get proper wages and unionize and all of that stuff. Is there any religion or set of religions in Latin America who are supporting those same types of movements today?
Yeah, there are, but on a much smaller scale than before. And they would also tend to still be the leftist Catholics and some more left of center historic Protestants, such as Presbyterians and Methodists. But by and large, the kind of dynamism that you saw of a kind of Christian left in the 60s and 70s really doesn't exist so much more anymore in Latin America. Chavez was kind of attempting to resurrect it to some extent in Venezuela, but I don't think that's been so successful. Again, and part of the reason, besides the whole Vatican offensive against it, led by John Paul II and Pope Benedict XVI as well, is the fact that it was kind of a very rational theology that de-emphasized the saints and miracles and such. And folk Catholicism, popular Catholicism in Latin America, really historically has centered on the saints, the various manifestations of the Virgin, and miracles as well. And so liberation theology really kind of alienated a lot of people who they thought they were targeting by kind of de-emphasizing the miraculous.
So are these various religions you're talking, both the folk saint cults like Santa Muerte and the Pentecostal religions, are they apolitical? Are they conservative? What's going on in terms of the larger political picture in Latin America?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's kind of hard to generalize, but I think we've had enough studies on Pentecostals lately to show that, in general, they really, despite their kind of being stereotyped as fairly conservative politically, that in general they really, their voting patterns really don't differ from the general Latin American electorate. And so, you know, there are leftist Pentecostals in Brazil, but of course we've had neo-fascist Pentecostals like Rios Montt, who was just sentenced for genocide in Guatemala.
Right.
So the Pentecostals have just grown to such an extent that they really kind of run the gamut politically. Catholic charismatics also probably tend to be more centrist and center-right. Politically, they've elected some of their own officials in Brazil, and they tend to be more center-right.
But as you've pointed out in some of your other writings, which we've talked about, the way they get so many followers is by serving the poor. How do they do that?
Well, they serve the poor not so much in terms of the type of philanthropy and social service projects that the larger Catholic Church or some of the more historic Protestant churches, but by really more kind of catering to the specific spiritual needs of the poor. And again, I'm going to go back to what I keep talking about, and that's miracles. People really are looking for all kinds of what we might consider to be mundane miracles, but, you know, to turn that part-time job into a full-time job, or have the daughter cured of whatever illness she's suffering from. Those are the type of things that people really are looking for at the grassroots from their religious experience in Latin America. And if you don't deliver on that, then you probably have no future in the business of religion in the Latin American context, or I should also say much of the African and Asian context as well.
Are you saying that these religions deliver miracles?
Yes, I would say that millions of people believe that they are able to realize miracles through their affiliation with certain denominations, folk saints, whatever. Sure.
I mean, one thinks, looking at it from the outside, that, and certainly looking at American televangelism and things like that, they deliver a whole lot of hope, but not a whole lot of substance.
Well, yeah, no doubt they deliver that, but there's also a lot of people out there who feel like they are able to turn their lives around due to the type of, let's say, prosperity preaching that they hear through these televangelists. And so while you might think there's a lot of hokum as you're watching them, there's a considerable number of people out there who feel like they're able to make positive changes in their lives because of the instruction, because of the preaching they hear from these televangelists. And I should add that the health and wealth gospel or prosperity theology is also very popular in Latin America as well, Latin American Pentecostalism.
Very interesting. I was thinking when I was looking at the Santa Muerte, I mean, we have this skeleton saint who a lot of people use, and she's gotten a bad reputation because she's also used by narcotraficantes and people who are involved in really the darkest kind of violence anywhere in the United States and in Mexico and on the border and so on, as well as thousands or millions of ordinary Mexican people. But Catholicism seems to be able to handle purity and kindness and saintly martyrdom a lot better than perfectly normal things like sexuality and various kinds of desire and darker things like violence, which are also part of our nature. And one does wonder how Catholicism at this point in history can hope to attract any new followers at all.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I go back to that's one of the main reasons, besides theological convictions of the new pope, why we're seeing such an emphasis on the poor. Because the church realizes that its great future growth is going to be in the global South, Latin America, Africa, and Asia. And if it doesn't speak to the spiritual and material needs of folks in those regions, the global South, then it has no future. And I think I'll go back again to the Catholic Charismatic Movement, or officially called the Catholic Charismatic Renewal. It really has made some headway in resuscitating the Catholic Church in parts of Latin America, particularly in Brazil and Guatemala. A recent Pew Foundation survey found in Brazil, our largest Catholic nation on earth, that over 60% of Catholics see themselves as charismatics. And keep in mind that the Catholic Charismatic Movement only arrives in Brazil in the early 1970s. So that figure is really astonishing. It's about the same for Guatemala as well. Catholicism is thoroughly charismatic in Africa as well, the Philippines also. So I think there is a lot of potential for growth, particularly with the dynamism of the Catholic Charismatic Renewal. And although the Pope hasn't made specific pronouncements so far, he's kind of alluded to it today as we're in the epic of the era of Pentecost, but I think it's the charismatics who are going to be the real foot soldiers of his program of new evangelization, trying to reconvert lapsed Catholics and to convert those who never were.
And with this new pope, I mean, if I may ask it in a rather crude manner, what's in it for them? What's in it for the lapsed Catholic or the new convert?
I guess the hope is that they will find a reinvigorated Catholicism, more in tune with the world, and one that isn't so kind of navel gazing, so kind of insular. The Pope has also made repeated pronouncements of how the Church needs to engage with the world and stop, you know, always looking inward as well. So I'm thinking that the hope is that people will find a kind of more jubilant, joyous, Pentecostal-style experience, particularly in the global South. Because, again, often here in the United States and also in Western Europe, we kind of get preoccupied with a lot of concerns that are specific to the global North. And I'll tell you, one of them, for example, the nuns, the American nuns have been in the news a lot lately for not being in favor with the Vatican. Well, the whole gender issue really is not so much front and center in the global South as it is here in the United States and the Western Europe. So many times the concerns and the agenda in the global South don't converge with what North American and European Catholics are interested in. And at the end of the day, the Vatican really needs to worry more about the agenda of the global South, since that's where almost 70% of Catholics reside today, and that figure only will be growing in the near future.
It seems like if you're going to really work in the interests of the people, eventually you can't avoid things like social justice, exploitation, and environmental destruction, which are the hallmarks of our world today because of the economic system under which the whole world is basically living right now. Is the Catholic Church showing any signs of taking that on?
Oh, yeah. You know, the Pope just the other day was railing against the exploitative world economic system. Yeah, he's made what sound like some fairly radical pronouncements. He obviously had the tragedy in Bangladesh in mind, where almost 1,000 workers were killed in that collapsed sweatshop over there. So yeah, he's been very vocal, and he was in Argentina as well for criticizing what he sees as a global economic system that tends to, you know, always put profits above people. Obviously, he was no friend of liberation theology back in Argentina, as many of his Jesuit confreres in Argentina were. So we can't mistake that this is a call for some kind of Christian socialism. It's not. It's a call for kind of a more humane, Keynesian-type capitalism.
Andrew Chesnut is professor of religious studies at Virginia Commonwealth University, where he's the Bishop Sullivan Chair in Catholic Studies. His most recent book is Devoted to Death, Santa Muerte, the Skeleton Saint, and he blogs for the Huffington Post. And your book is just recently translated into Spanish, is that correct?
Not yet. I just signed a contract, but yes, it will come out in Spanish with Planeta Press from Mexico, in Mexico, throughout Spanish-speaking Latin America, and also here in the United States. So it should be out this fall.
Very interesting. Do you expect that to be read by, I mean, ordinary people, should we say, as opposed to academics?
I do, especially because this is a trade press who's going to be publishing it, so they have access to, you know, a much larger, more popular market than the academic press that I publish with here in the United States. So yeah, I think and pretty much all Latin Americans today, even if they're not in Mexico or in Argentina or Guatemala, have heard of Santa Muerte, particularly now because of the Vatican's condemnation just in the last month.
So we will be seeing it in botanicas around the world.
You will. You will.
Andrew Chesnut, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me back, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Shannon Martin Roberts. She's executive director of the Santa Fe Children's Museum, and Julie DeFeo, who is director of marketing and community relations there. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you are the new, you just started recently at the Children's Museum.
I've been at the museum for about a month, and a full-time resident of Santa Fe, I'm happy to say, for about a month.
But you've been coming here for many years.
Many years, yes. Santa Fe was one of my first loves, and I had the opportunity, particularly when my daughter was very young. She's now 20, but when she was very young, we were living in London, and we would come and spend many, many months in Santa Fe. And it was our opportunity to enjoy the wonderful blue skies and the hospitality, and we found our home at the Santa Fe Children's Museum. And that really made an impact on me as a young mother and really influenced my career. And I've come full circle and now have the honor of being the director.
So the Children's Museum basically provides a place to play and learn for kids of what ages?
Oh, goodness. We welcome children of all ages. We do have a very young area for those kids who are still crawling. But really, I would say that beginning at the point where they can walk, and they all walk at different ages, say two, they can begin to motor around the museum and touch and feel and experience all of the different exhibits, all the way up to, you know, we're now doing programming for 8 to 12-year-olds. So that is something that's important to us and that we're really excited about and getting great feedback. So we don't really say there's a certain age. We try and offer something that's inspiring for all, particularly families that have different ages in them. And honestly, I see some of the older kids having as much fun with building Legos and doing things like that as the young ones.
It's so important, I think, I would think, for a children's museum to understand child development and what kids need at different stages and what really helps their minds and their senses and their motor skills and all of that stuff to develop and grow.
Mm-hmm. And that's so important in our particular museum. And the thing really, again, as a young mother that inspired me, there are no directions. There's no specific way that you're supposed to walk through the museum or the way that you're supposed to play with something. The children are free to explore. And that really is that exploration, letting them discover and ask questions. And our staff, our floor staff, is there also to guide that. And they might ask a child a question and begin a conversation and not give an answer, but allow them to explore. And I think the perfect example of that is the bubble making. You know, how does that actually work? I mean, it's one of the great favorites, but, you know, there's a little more to it. And if you rub it and you get friction, then this happens. And you know, I think that's the beauty of the museum. And one reason why it appeals to so many different ages. There are messages all along the way and conversations that can happen regardless of age.
Right. So a 40-year-old child might walk in and say, I want to play with bubbles.
Oh, absolutely. We have one of my favorite things that I've noticed is we have an area where the kids can do face paint. It's very, very popular. And next to the young kids that walk out the door covered in their makeup, it's dads. I've noticed that the dads are the second most popular, and what I love is watching them because they're walking out of there very proud. I'm not sure if they're putting it on, if it's a collaboration with the kids, but I mean, it's really great. I mean, it's a place where people can just be themselves and explore and, you know, build something great or get a little dirty outside.
And there's all sorts of other things, too. What are some of the other highlights that are in the museum right now?
You know, one of my favorite parts of the museum is coming back to life after the winter, and that's our outside exploration area. It's called Earthworks, and it is an amazing, about an acre garden with everything from musical instruments that the kids can play to actually works that happen in the spring in New Mexico. For example, we have to rebuild some of our adobe structures. And we have young interns that come in and work all summer and help build it. And the great thing about it is it's not like we close the doors on a certain day and block it all off for visitors not to experience it. The idea is that visitors can actually help build adobe bricks and learn how that process and just get out there and get a little dirty. And I think that's something that all visitors just love to do. This summer in July, we're building an Orno. And the visitors can participate with that. And then we're going to start baking in the Orno, which
nice.
I'm personally looking very forward to.
So do you then have, I mean, you put in the newspaper, whatever, okay, today is bread baking day.
Yes.
Everybody show up at 9 o'clock and here we go.
Yes. On our website, it's pretty easy to find. It's just one click away, our daily events, and you can go through and you can plan your visit. They're also welcome to call. And when you walk in the museum, you see everything that's available on that particular day. And, you know, again, if you're interested in coming out and doing some things out in the garden and learning about adobe brick making, I would encourage you to give it a call or look on the website.
Now, I guess children's museums have to be called museums because that's like the closest paradigm, but it's not really a museum. I mean, museums are art usually where you can't touch anything. In children's museums, you have to touch every year. That's the whole
idea.
It's
all about the touch, yes.
Now, do you have the equivalent of changing exhibitions? I mean, do you have things that come in for a while?
We do, and as a matter of fact, we've just opened a new collaborative exhibit last Friday called The Science of Cities. It was a great opportunity for us to partner. The Dell Foundation helped us to realize the project. We wanted to develop something that was, again, for that older audience. And we partnered with the New Mexico Highlands University, one of their classes, the Santa Fe Institute, and the Department of Cultural Affairs. And all of these different groups came together. The class at New Mexico Highlands was able to go and visit other children's museums and come and look at our challenges. And really, they were supposed to develop one exhibit. Well, if you were to come and see the new things at the museum, you would realize that they were so inspired and so enthusiastic that, in fact, they took a real holistic view of the museum. And we've even changed some things about the museum, such as some of the colors and some of the things that are more adult level, if you will, that are really inspirational. And then the science of the cities comes out of a lot of research that was done from the Santa Fe Institute, and it just talks about what makes a city. And they were able to drill that down to the youngest of our visitors, and everyone else. And the nice thing about it is our youngest visitors, there's things like who makes a city as part of it. And there are pictures of different types of individuals, and one of them is a baker. And they're what we call smell boxes. And right at the perfect level for a young person, and they can go and smell the box and decide what that smell, how it relates to one of the individuals that they look at. My favorite one is the baker because, well, I like baked goods. So.
It would be interesting to have the science of the city next to the science of the ant colony.
Well, and there's some similarities. I mean, we have cross-sections of what makes a city. And, one of the videos that are, the accelerated motion of some of the processes that happen in a city. And you know, that's really fun because even a 3 or 4 year old loves watching that, rapid video. And they're taking something in from that. You know, this is our water process. This is our recycling process. They're familiar enough to know they turn on the faucet and there's the water, but really where does it come from? And then, of course, that helps them to engage the conversation with the adult. And the nice thing, too, is that of course, the parents and the adults that are coming in, they have something, too, different to engage with. And they're enjoying looking at the various things that make a city. And it really is thoughtful about, okay, we know that people make it, but how does that relate back to, different size cities and buildings and things like that?
We're talking to Shannon Martin Roberts and Julie DeFeo of the Santa Fe Children's Museum. Now, you are, Shannon, the new executive director, and as probably most of the people listening to this broadcast know, the Santa Fe Children's Museums went through some pretty serious problems and financial problems and all kinds of things, and there were fundraisers and all kinds of stuff. And what's involved with keeping a children's museum solvent?
You know, it really is a balance, and that is my goal. There's the balance of programming that's enriching for a community and making sure that you keep the favorites but also bringing new ideas and new concepts, and then making sure that museum is sustainable. And I am very focused on both and trying very hard to balance both. Sustainability is, it comes from the community and it comes from within. So how do we bring in money that's earned revenue? Our birthday parties is a great example. Our beautiful home that we have, and how can the community use that beautiful home? And then, it is working with our partners out in the community, and the great example of that is the Stell Foundation grant and these partnerships that formed during that difficult and challenging time. I mean, from that challenge came some really amazing individuals and partnerships that help sustain and make us more efficient in the way that we do things.
There are some specific programs and events that the Children's Museum does. What are some of those that are coming up this summer?
Well, of course, first is our summer camps, which are very popular, and there's a whole variety of topics. And we have them
like summer camp. You drop the kid off in the morning, pick him up in the afternoon.
Yeah, for a whole week. So the week would focus on a particular topic. Say minerals and dinosaurs is one of them. There's I think it's called Live from Broadway. It's an acting camp, which is really fun, and the kids do a little performance at the end of the week. So we've got a variety of those for different age groups. So now is the time to sign up for those. And the other thing, as Shannon mentioned earlier, is that we're really trying to expand our programming to include what for us is the older age range of the kids, the 8 to 12. And that's the age range where what we see is a lot of these kids that have been coming to the museum since they were little. Around 8 to 9, developmentally, they start to feel like, maybe I'm outgrowing this. So we recognize that and want to keep them engaged in the museum and keep that hands-on learning, participatory learning happening. So we've really focused on workshops for them. And they're really cool things, like we've done a couple of animation workshops, paper stop motion. We did a sewing workshop. And what's coming up next is a water rocket workshop, which is completely full and sold out.
Sold out within 4 seconds.
Yeah, so we're going to add another one. So keep, you know, look on our website for when we have the next date for that, because that's going to be really fun. And then a comic book workshop. And that's coming up in June, the 8th and the 9th. It's a 2-day workshop.
Where kids only?
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you say that, because that's exactly the response that we're getting, is that adults really want to learn to do this. We have a very cool 3D printer. Everybody's dying to print on it, you know, make something on a 3D printer.
Yeah.
So that is another way that we will sustain ourselves, is taking in this reaction from adults and putting that in place.
Yeah.
And these programs stem out of a movement in the country that's called the Makers Movement. And that started out as what they call themselves techno geeks, people that love to go in and manipulate any kind of programming with computers and just kind of play with that stuff. And that for quite a few years has been focused on adults only. And we've taken that idea and said, well, kids in that age, that middle school to high school age, that really would appeal to them. And that would be something that's a natural extension of what we do with the hands-on learning. So you've got in one place in the museum, kids playing with bubbles and balls and that kind of thing. And then you've got another place where they would be, potentially we're going to work up to where they'd be doing computer animation, game design, comic book, and, you know, all of these kinds of things that are still in the same model, but are a bit more edgy and cool for those kids.
It would be really interesting to see what they come up with. Some of those kids are going to have some great comic books.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the fun of it, too. Again, is in the mission of the museum, is it's kind of open-ended. We give you some parameters. Here are some things to play with. What can you do with this? How far can you take this? And it's really exciting to bring in that extension of that age group, because we can see how much further they're going to enrich things with their imagination.
Shannon Martin Roberts, what is the background that you bring to the Children's Museum?
Not only was I a parent and came to this museum, but I think what's really important is, again, it inspired the direction of my career. And I eventually had the opportunity to be the director of the Dallas Children's Museum,
uh-huh,
which was actually inspired by the Santa Fe Children's Museum. And, you know, so I have that connector. Interestingly enough, the Dallas Children's Museum at the time was also facing some challenges. They'd completely outgrown their space. So I understand the dynamics of a children's museum, but also the needs of the museum.
Yeah.
But I also, I think importantly in what the Blue Ribbon Task Force said, I do have an MBA. And of course, when you go to business school, it's all about theory and things on paper. But I've had the opportunity, you know, I've had the opportunity to actually experience it. So I think I come with that sensitivity of, this is a beloved treasure in the community, as was the Dallas Children's Museum, for example. And so how do you preserve that? But how do you also grow it and sustain it and keep it modern, you know? I mean, keep it evolving. And, you know, one of the great things that I've experienced in my brief time as a brand new community person here is just people coming from everywhere wanting to tell me about their experiences as a child at the museum, and now they're taking their children. And it's important that they see the museum evolve.
It's been around for so long.
We're going to celebrate our 30th anniversary next year.
Oh, my goodness. So you really do have parents coming who had been at the museum.
Yes. And it's important for them to walk in and see some old favorites, but then also to see how it's evolved. And that's a real balance, and one that I understand. You know, because they want to walk in and make bubbles, but they also, it's, you know, 20 years later or what have you, and want to also experience some new things. And you know, parents are really well informed. They're out on the internet, they're learning about child development. And so we have to really be able to address that with what we're offering. And I have a really passionate staff that love what they do. And that's another thing that I hear when I'm out in the community, the engagement on the floor. You know, it's just not a place that you walk in and pay your money and then you just go do your thing. We really do have educators out there who are not interrupting, but they're adding to.
Do you ever have to tell the parents, chill out and let your kid play?
I haven't done that, but I've definitely seen some of our educators and in my career sort of suggest that. Yes. Yes. Now, you know, of course, we love to have that participation. I mean, the whole point is that you're engaging with your child. But sometimes the point really is let them make something, not the perfect art piece, right? Yeah. It's perfect to them.
Right.
And that's what's important. And just the exploration of, ooh, yeah, it's all black, and maybe I didn't intend it to be all black, but that's because I combined these two colors, and that's what happened. That's the point, not the beauty.
Yeah, exactly. And as we've learned recently on this show from a wonderful psychologist of child cognition, if you explain to a kid how to do something, it actually stifles their ability to do it a different way.
I was just going to say and add to that, because I started my career at the museum on the floor as an educator and floor manager, and I think part of that also speaks to your question about being knowledgeable about development, child development, and putting all those things together. It's just giving an area where there's permission for the child to be where they are in their developmental stage, and for the parent to also be engaged in that, because it's pretty unusual for kids these days with how regimented school can be to just like, I'm just going to experiment and I'm just going to see what can happen here. And at some developmental stages, it's really important for the child to do a repetitive action. So we'll see parents come in and say, you know, my son just always wants to go and stand by the water every single time, over and over and over again. And I try to get him to go to something else, but he won't. Well, he's mastering something in that moment.
And you don't know what it is, and you don't know what that kid's experience is.
You just have to have faith in it and just give the room and the permission for it to happen.
And I think this is, and I'm a great example, it's just as important to me that we are inspiring those caregivers and those parents. I was completely inspired by my time there, and you see it with a parent. You see them suddenly make this connection, and you go home. I learned how to make homemade Play-Doh, for example, and you know, that was really cool. I love to cook, and my daughter, we weren't necessarily cooking together at the time because I thought she was too young, and this was a great example of no, she wasn't too young to cook.
Shannon Martin Roberts is executive director of the Santa Fe Children's Museum. Julie DeFeo is director of marketing and communications. It's on the web at santafechildrensmuseum.org.
Yes.
Great to have you both on the Radio
Cafe.
Thank you so much.